Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week, we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week, I'm happy to say we have Jeff Resnick on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, John Galsworthy and the Disabled Soldiers of the Great War. You have probably heard of John Galsworthy, although you don't remember where. I'm here to tell you that you have heard of him because he is the author of the Forsyte Saga, and you undoubtedly have seen some production of the Forsyte Saga. One of the things you might not know about the author of the Forsyte Saga, that is John Galsworthy, is that he was quite a humanitarian. He was extremely important in creating the modern infrastructure for the care of veterans who had returned from one or another wars. Galsworthy witnessed soldiers returning from the Great War, soldiers who had been maimed during their time at the front, and he understood that they were in need of help, that is, help to reintegrate into society, and he made it his cause. He raised a lot of money for these soldiers, he helped to found hospitals for them, and he wrote extensively about them, and that really is what Jeff's book is about. I knew that Galsworthy was a great man, but I didn't know how great he was until I read Jeff's really terrific book. I highly recommend it to you. And without further ado, here's the interview. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Marshall. How are you?
I'm very well. You are in Washington, D.C., is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
And how is the weather there?
The weather is cool and rainy today, unfortunately.
Oh, well, it's really. I used to live in Washington, D.C., and the summers there I found very nice. I should tell our listeners that we're talking to Jeff Resnick today, and we'll be discussing his terrific new book, John Galsworthy and the Disabled Soldiers of the Great War. I have read the book, and I'm telling you it is extraordinarily interesting. For those of you who are interested in what might be called medical history and also the history of warfare and the care for soldiers, this is a book that you'll want to read. One thing that I really like about it is that it includes some of Galsworthy's writings, and I would even say lesser-known writings. So for fans of the Forsyte Saga and so on and so forth, this is, again, a book that you will probably want to read. The book is of relevance today, given the fact that we, that is the United States, is at war, and we might just discuss that a little bit during the interview. But, Jeff, let me ask you to begin our conversation by telling us a few words about yourself.
Sure. Thanks. And thanks, Marshall, for having me on your great show. I'm a big fan.
My
pleasure. Appreciate it very much and appreciate your interest in the book. So I was born in Rochester, New York, and I was raised there and attended the University of Rochester and then went on to Emory University, where I received my PhD in history from the history department there. I relocated to the D.C. area about a decade ago and have been involved with the nonprofit sector here for several years while pursuing historical research in a variety of capacities. And currently I am the deputy chief of the History of Medicine Division at the National Library of Medicine. I should say that the book that I've written was written before I took this position. So just to make that clear, and again, appreciate being on the show.
Yeah, sure. I just always marvel at people that can have day jobs and write books. So you get a big gold star on your notebook for me for that, because it's really quite an accomplishment.
Well, thanks. It's a function of kind of moving beyond academia for several years, outside academia, if you will, and as I said, worked in the nonprofit sector. So I did wear those two hats, and I'm very grateful that the nonprofit organizations that I did serve in an executive capacity allowed me that time to pursue the historical research. Those communities, medical communities, were particularly interested in the work that I did. So, yeah, it's kind of a dual track, and, and I had largely an administrative career in the nonprofit sector, so it was particularly difficult in that regard. So thanks for your observations.
Yeah,
in that respect.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks.
So tell me how you got interested in World War One.
So my interest in World War One is rooted firmly in my my childhood on the one hand. As I said, I grew up in Rochester, and thanks very much to my father, who introduced me to history through the libraries and museums of upstate New York and Canada, particularly Rochester, my hometown, Buffalo and Toronto. So I grew up with history being very much a center of my life, outings and such with my dad and my family generally. So I went on to the University of Rochester, as I mentioned, where I took a few courses in modern British history, one in particular from a gentleman named Stuart Weaver, who's still there at the U of R. And in that course, I read for the first time the vast amount of literature that came out of the war to end all wars, Sassoon, Graves, Wilfred Owen, and the rest of the Oxbridge writers, and was really captivated by it, as most people are. And really, that was a pivotal point for me to want to explore it in greater depth, which I went on to do at Emory. But rather than focus on the canon of wartime literature at Emory, I became interested in kind of those pockets of material in the archives that reveal other voices, lesser known voices, that took part in various ways at the home front and on the war front in World War I. And so that research revealed to me these voices in hospitals and convalescent depots and such, and that really became the core of my first book, which is called Healing the Nation, Soldiers and the Culture of Caregiving in Britain During the Great War. And it was kind of a telescoping, really, of that very early interest in history all the way through the University of Rochester and culminating in my doctoral work. And it continues now through this book. So in a nutshell, that's really it.
Mm-hmm, I see. Well, let's begin by setting the scene just a little bit. This is more or less a hypothesis on my part, so tell me if it's true. I don't think that people in World War I were prepared for the return of many, many, many horribly crippled soldiers. They knew that war was violent, but World War I was more violent. And they also knew that most wounds on the battlefield of the 19th century were more or less fatal, largely due to sepsis. But I think after the discovery of the germ theory of disease, a lot of these guys survived, and this created a problem. Does that sound right?
Right. So that's correct. There was knowledge and a memory, distant somewhat, of the American Civil War, but the way in which most people thought about waging the war to end all wars was how they did it in the 19th century, really at the turn of the century. And so that was really the expectation. But with the war machine being what it was, there was a way in which these men, those who did survive, were returned home and wounded for life. And so the expectations that this war be a lot like the 19th century on the one hand, and then the lack of preparation, really, that it was as long as it was and that it was as severe as it was due to the mechanistic nature of the Western Front and other fronts, combined to reveal a war that was much more than anyone had anticipated. So Galsworthy was one of those people who was horrified by the war as it settled in to be a reality in the late summer and fall of 1914. And he and many others of his generation, younger generation particularly, were not expecting what was going to unfold. Mm-hmm. And that was really that sets the stage for the first part of the story that I tell in, mm-hmm. in this book.
Mm-hmm. Before we go into Galsworthy himself, let me ask you this. What sort of infrastructure, to use a word I don't really like, was there in Britain for the taking care of, retraining, and reentry of wounded soldiers into civilian life? How did they care for people who had come back from, I don't know, the Sudan campaign or the Boer War or something? What did they do with them?
Well, the plans that were put in motion in 1914 were largely based on those previous arrangements. And in my first book, I talk a little bit about those precedents, if you will, to providing that infrastructure, both the official military infrastructure and the voluntary aid programs that were complements to the official infrastructure. So they didn't create it out of nowhere, as you well know and others well know. They worked according to what had been done before, and what had been done before was largely not very methodical, although there was an understanding of lines of communication stretching back from the war front to the home front, whereby you'd have the aid post and then further back the stationary hospital and then perhaps a hospital barge or an ambulance a train that could transport the wounded further back to the hospitals but way behind the lines or perhaps at home, and then the convalescent stage if they survived through illness and injury in those other spaces of care, if you will, they would be transferred to a convalescent space, which would either be an official convalescent depot or a voluntary aid detachment convalescent facility run by the British Red Cross and the Order of St. John. So that's the generally the arrangement. And in my first book, I talk about that structure and try to set the stage for a discussion of the experiences inside those institutional spaces that I described.
Mm-hmm. The reason I ask is mm-hmm. because most Americans, and I probably think most people listening to this show, will have firmly fixed in their mind the institution of the Veterans Administration, the VA, right. and VA mm-hmm. hospitals that are scattered in almost, I don't know, I was going to say every community in the United States, but certainly every community of any size has a veterans hospital of some sure. sort of VA hospital. Did they have anything of that nature?
Well, in some ways, yes. The regional character of the VA today mirrors somewhat the regional character of the voluntary aid organizations that provided a certain amount of care to wounded veterans. So the British Red Cross and Order of St. John worked together during World War I in Britain and created these convalescent homes, a network of hospitals, if you will, during the war and for several years, you know, thereafter. But it was a network based on kind of a loose administration, if you will. I mean, there were central reporting structures, and there's a wonderful document, about 900 pages, that describes the efforts of the British Red Cross and Order of St. John in all of these communities across all the counties of Britain. So they did report up into some central structure, but that's about where it stops. In other words, there's no obviously direct line of historical development between today's VA and what transpired in World War I, although, again, that general regional character is reflective of the fact that individuals, men from all corners of Britain, and in many cases in some towns, the majority or near majority of young men in those towns went to war, and emerging from that was a need to, if they came home, to provide some level of care for them. So in general terms, the regional structure is a good way, I think, to think about how we see the VA today and other veterans resources as well. So that's actually a very helpful way to look at it.
So this is my last question on the subject, but I have to confess almost complete ignorance. Were these convalescent homes funded charitably, or did they receive any funding from the state?
So they were run primarily by the voluntary sector. So they did receive funding. They were charitable entities, so they would receive funding from local groups that would participate in some of the events. So if they had a library or a lawn party, a fete, if you will, they would rely upon local citizens to raise money to benefit the facility. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there was a measure of support, not necessarily from the state, but from the British Red Cross Order St. John's Central Office in London. And that's a very good question. And how much support they got is really mitigated by how generous the community was in supporting their particular facility. Mm-hmm. So this is reflective in the archives by buttons and badges and banners and posters that you'd see encouraging local citizens to come out and support their hospital or their convalescent facility. And I should say also that many of these facilities were private homes that were turned over by citizens for such use. So they were themselves charitable structures in many ways. And in fact, Galsworthy lent his home in London for this very purpose.
Yeah, let's actually transition now to Galsworthy and see mm-hmm. if we can weave together these two threads. That is the history of the care of soldiers and Galsworthy. Tell us a little bit about Galsworthy's life, beginning, I guess, from the beginning. He was he had a kind of privileged upbringing, didn't he? And then, well, you can take it from there.
Yeah, well, he grew up in the late 1860s when he was born, and did indeed have a very privileged upbringing. And this is very much reflected in the character of literature that he's become known for, late Victorian or Edwardian style literature. And in fact, it's also reflective in his most famous piece, which is the Foresight Saga, the story of an upper middle class family, and three books and several what Galsworthy called interludes constitute the story of this very privileged family and their growth and relationships. And of course, this itself has been made famous by the two productions in Britain, one in the 60s and one, I believe it was in the 90s. And that really is itself reflective of Galsworthy's life, as I said. So what's curious is the fact that the writings that I reproduce in my book, Galsworthy's writings, are indeed very unknown relative to the Foresight Saga. Mm-hmm. And they're also very unknown relative to another accolade that Galsworthy has become known for, which is the 1932 Nobel Prize in Literature, which he was awarded. That was 1 year before he died in 1933. So the book features a segment of his life that has been referenced by many historians and discussed just briefly here and there. But I really try to reveal the big story and the full story of his engagement in World War I that others have just kind of referenced and kind of glossed over for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, he did make it his cause. He was a tremendously popular writer. I mean, he was very well known in the knots and the teens, wasn't he?
Yes, that's correct. Yes, he in his lifetime he published 20 plus novels, hundreds of short stories, plays. His plays were tremendously popular. Not all of them, I should say, but many of them were among the most popular. And he was, as you say, a very, very popular individual. And I tell the story in the book, he really leveraged that popularity for the cause of looking after men who'd been returned home with severe wounds. And
just to put it in perspective so people will understand, would he have been thought of in the same way as someone like George Bernard Shaw?
Well, in fact, sure. He was a contemporary of Shaw, alongside others, H.G. Wells, John Buchan, this was a group of about two dozen writers who were the elite of Britain, the cream of the crop, and among the most celebrated of their day. And these writers, as I mentioned in the book, came together at the request of the government in September of 1914 to form what was called the War Propaganda Bureau. They were all looked to for support in writing propaganda in support of the state, and Galsworthy joined them at the table at this meeting in London in early September. And so the book reflects on that. Others have told the story of the War Propaganda Bureau in much greater detail than I do. What I try to do in my book is show that Galsworthy believed in supporting the nation going to war, but he abhorred war. He was sickened by the mere thought that the nation was going to war, but he wanted to do something good. He wanted to make a contribution to the effort. He was 47 years old when the war revealed itself, when the war broke out, and he was too old to fight. He wasn't particularly well. He had a bad shoulder. He had bad eyesight, and he felt very much disabled by his own physical condition, a medical community that deemed him too old to fight. And so he looked inward to really the only ability and skill that he had to make a difference, which was his writing. So he joined the War Propaganda Bureau for a period of time and then seemed to break from it as the reality of the war set in, as the increasing numbers of wounded soldiers were returned home. The reality was there, and he felt that mere propaganda was not good enough. So he turned his writing skills and his energy to writing in a way that could raise public awareness of the return of these men and to raise some money for their institutions, for hospitals that were providing them care, but also in a very prophetic way. He conveyed the deep problem that the nation was encountering by welcoming these men home, and really he needed to help people recognize that. He wanted to help people recognize that these men were, if they survived, they were going to be with the nation for decades to come. And the nation really needed to wake up and understand that part of the mission here, going to war, was certainly, you know, winning the war, but providing proper support for those who had done their bit at the front and were going to be with the nation for many decades. And so his later writings were very passionate articulations of the support that he hoped the nation could provide these men. And the book goes into great detail and describes how the disability that Galsworthy felt was kind of a reflective in his passionate interest in disabled men.
It was his own disability that provided a kind of doorway for his interest in disabled soldiers and their rehabilitation. I find the entire process by which the government co-opted, I guess I want to say, these sort of, I want to call them stars of print, because that's really what they were. They were sort of rock stars of their day, and it was the first generation of really kind of literary rock stars, I think. I don't, you know, prior to the coming of mass print, which is really a late 19th century phenomenon, I don't think that there were people like this, but I'm reminded of people like, I don't know, Angelina Jolie or Bono, as in you these people that are, you know, they're always, it's sort of a rite of passage now for stars to go pick a cause and then contribute. And I think Galsworthy was obviously one of the first people to do this. I imagine that his motives were much purer, you'll pardon me for saying, than some people doing it today. But in any event, what exactly did Galsworthy do? What were the nature of his activities in the benefit of these wounded soldiers?
So Galsworthy initially wrote when he broke more or less from the War Propaganda Bureau, wrote a few pieces for hospitals in Britain, particularly the Queen Mary's Hospital in an area called Roehampton, which is south of London. And so his initial work was largely, you know, in earnest writing for these institutions. And then he had an opportunity, as I share in the book, to volunteer at a Red Cross, a French Red Cross hospital in the south of France, and took that opportunity with his wife toward the middle part of the war. And he traveled with his wife to France, to this hospital, Hospital Beneval, it was called, where he was a masseur, and his wife was a linen superintendent, taking care of all the linens in the institution. And from that experience, wrote another set of fiction, short stories, about his experiences with those disabled French soldiers. And after, this was a period of about 3.5-4 months that he spent his time in France at this hospital, and then subsequently traveled to Lyon and then to Paris to visit several other institutions that were providing various curative workshops and other so-called rehabilitation programs for disabled French soldiers. And this experience informed very much the writings that he undertook and the work that he undertook, voluntary work he undertook, when he returned to Britain within a few weeks. So he was only overseas for about 5 months. And then he undertook, at the request of the Ministry of Pensions, the editorship of a magazine called Reveille, and brought together many of these literary colleagues of his, many of whom you met, many of whom you've mentioned, H.G. Wells, Arnold Bennett, Mayfield, Buchan, Edith Wharton, James, to create a magazine that was, in an earlier fashion, not particularly creative, very, very administrative in how it was communicating the needs of disabled soldiers. So Galsworthy put a creative spin on this through the help of many of his literary friends, and edited this magazine for it only existed for 3 issues, so for about a year and a half or thereabouts. And this editorship that he oversaw connected also to his participation on the editorial committee of another magazine, a rather short-lived publication, for the Inter-Allied Conference, conferences on the aftercare of disabled soldiers. So he had this series of participation in the cause of disabled soldiers, from writing short pieces on his own, to the voluntary work he did overseas, and then the work that he did at the request of the Ministry of Pensions. Work, as I say in the book, as I share, ultimately he became quite disillusioned with.
Mm-hmm. Why did these publications – it doesn't seem they lasted very long. Was he you'll pardon me for saying this, or maybe his relatives will pardon me for saying this. Was he a difficult man, or did he, as you say, just become disillusioned with the people he was working with?
I don't believe, based on everything I've read and the historical record I've looked at, that he was necessarily difficult or difficult to work with. And I say that because I've read quite carefully the correspondence between Galsworthy and his literary colleagues, and also administrators in the Ministry of Pensions. I think difficult is quite creative. I think he was quite innovative in how he wanted to approach the problem. I think he became difficult when the Ministry of Pensions imposed censorship rules on the publication, Reveille, that Galsworthy disagreed with, because he really wanted to have a freer voice to convey the scope of the problems at hand and the gravity of the situation. So I think he became reasonably difficult at that point, and then he became disillusioned. But I think his intentions, if you one would say pure, they were quite sincere in the sense that he wanted to dedicate, he did dedicate his time and his energy and a great deal of money to this cause. Now, you're right, the publications did not have a long lifespan. They were, in essence, quite ephemeral, and therein lies kind of the latter part of my contribution to this book, where I talk about Galsworthy's acknowledgement of the ephemeral way in which the nation was grappling with these problems. So there's a paradox there in many respects. And then the latter part of the book addresses the fact that Galsworthy became so disillusioned at the regulations that were being put upon him, and arguably also disillusioned with the damage being wrought on the battlefield and being returned home, the wounded men, that he, like many of his generation, became disillusioned with the war. And toward the end of the war and the years following, he thought little about the war. He wrote little about the war and wrote virtually nothing significant about that cause of supporting disabled soldiers that he was so passionate about during the war years. That's the latter part of the story.
That's fascinating. It kind of blotted it out of his life. Let's talk a little bit about disillusionment and begin with the subject of censorship, which you mentioned. I think that this is something that Americans tend to forget. That is that censorship in this era was more or less pervasive, accepted, and most people thought it was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the regime of censorship that the British imposed during the war and what Galsworthy thought about it.
Sure. So the censorship that Galsworthy encountered was put upon him by civil servants in the Ministry of Pensions, and they took issue with really the two things, the very graphic nature with which some of the contributions in Galsworthy's publication took up the issue of disability and disabled soldiers, and also statistically too, there was an effort to really cloak or veil what the true numbers of disabled soldiers were really the nation that was seeing. And so Galsworthy got in the middle of this, and the correspondence that he had with the civil servants really reflects this. And so there was really a tit-for-tat period of time during his editorship where he really felt that the right way to approach this was to be rather frank and honest and not obscure the reality. But the civil servants felt that in various ways there needed to be these greater controls on the publication. And so this is kind of ironic because when Galsworthy took up the publication in the first instance, as I share in my book, they wanted it to be a more popular, creative publication. He took it up from a gentleman named Lord Charnwood, and the publication was pretty much a failure, and that was recognized in various corners. So they wanted Galsworthy to pick it up and run with it. And so he had the freedom or the latitude initially, I believe, based on what I've seen in the record. But then as the war became much more damaging in all respects in late 1718, the tone and the approach of the government really, really changed. And I think issue number three, which appeared in early 1919, was the end of that publication. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Now, you say that some of Galsworthy's writings and some of the articles that appeared in Reveille were deemed by the censors to be too graphic. I think it's important to understand what that means in 1915 or 16, because I don't think it's our conception of graphic.
Sure, sure. Yeah. So the there were no illustrations in the publication beyond a couple of pen and ink sketches by a few of Galsworthy's literary colleagues. But by graphic, there was material that conveyed the really deep loss of young men to the nation. And I don't have a copy of the publication handy here, but there was material there that conveyed such a significant loss that the loss of this generation of men was something that was too explicit. And that was one thing that they took issue with. The other really was the fact that there was criticism of the Ministry of Pensions and their local committee structure to provide good service to disabled soldiers and their families. And Galsworthy and many of his writers wanted to criticize that local pensions committee structure. And that was something that was not much appreciated at all. And I should also say there were writers representing the Ministry of Pensions that Galsworthy worked with on this publication as well. But the voices of those who he brought to the table to contribute, those the contributors, I think were too, in some ways, too critical. And I think that was lurking for a period of time and became quite evident towards the formation of the at least the second issue of the magazine, and certainly the third.
Did he argue with the censors? I mean, did he go visit them and say, "Look, you have to let me write this because it's true"? Or how did their tête-à-tête unfold?
Yeah, so it unfolded through a series of letters that were written for a period of time on a daily basis between Galsworthy and one of the civil servants in the Ministry of Pensions. And this series of letters really reveals that for a concentrated period of time, that there was disagreement with what Galsworthy wanted to include in the publication. And so, again, the historical record is fully revealed through this series of correspondence.
Uh-huh. And how did the breakup actually occur? When Galsworthy said, "Okay, enough, I'm done," did he sort of stomp off in a snit, or did he just let the publication die?
Well, that's a very good question. There were a few final letters written, and there's one letter that reveals that he became so disillusioned he did essentially, I guess you'd say, stomp off. he let the publication die with a great deal of regret, because the historical record reveals, and this is correspondence in part between Galsworthy and his wife and some of their friends, that it was very unfortunate that this had to happen, and that's a publication with so much promise and so many wonderful contributors for the cause really didn't work out. So that was the end of Reveille. Mm-hmm. And portions of that publication, Galsworthy's essays and his contributions to the three issues, are reprinted in my book alongside. Mm-hmm. So those are the nonfiction part. The book is, as I said, also contains some of the fiction that he wrote in France that informed, as I mentioned, his thoughts and motivation toward editing Reveille.
Mm-hmm. Now, after Reveille, there is another publication, or do I have that backwards?
Well, Reveille was kind of the second generation of the publication that started out with under the editorship of Lord Charnwood. That was called Recall to Life. So that was a failure. That ran for three issues as well. Reveille then was kind of resurrected from the ashes of Recalled to Life. And then there was another publication that Galsworthy did not contribute to, but he was on the editorial board of, and that is the official publication of the Inter-Allied Conferences on the Aftercare of Disabled Men. So that was a very short-lived publication. So that was published in France, and Galsworthy's name appeared at the on the masthead of that. But it only existed, I think, for a few issues itself, and it was a more technical, scientific, medical journal as opposed to a creative one.
Yeah, he doesn't give up his advocacy though on behalf of wounded soldiers after Reveille. He continues to participate. What does he do exactly?
So in 1921, he wrote a short piece for the Disabled Society on for a handbook for the disabled, and kind of an introduction, if you will, to this resource book for disabled veterans. And I think it's 6 to 9 paragraphs. I didn't include it in my book. It's a coda to a significant coda to all the other material that he wrote, the numerous essays that are included. And the reason why it's significant is that it's so short and it's so lifeless in many ways, and that the passion with which he wrote during the war, and combined with the energy that he dedicated, the time he dedicated to the cause, it's not evident in the 1921, the short 1921 piece. And that's significant. There's an absence there of what was very present during the war years. So that's what he did in 1921. He between 1923 and 1924, began or published his collected works, what was called the Manaton collection of his works, a 20-some-odd volume collection. Volume 17 contains the wartime material, and there is a significant absence of nearly every one of the pieces he wrote in support of disabled soldiers. So there's one or two pieces there that kind of reference it, but there's no highlight of it. In addition to the fact that the introduction to that volume 17, Galsworthy essentially admits that, you know, this was a tough period, and I'm reproducing here what I think is important. So indirectly, he's saying, everything else was not necessarily important. And he, in my kind of point of view, he kind of blocks it out and presents the collected works based on how he felt they ought to be presented. Now, certainly there's a literary quality dimension to this, and I don't deny that, but isn't it significant that a famous author who published, as I said, 20-some-odd volumes and hundreds of essays and plays, and just kind of forgets conveniently in his collected works that there was a chapter of his life for 4 years that he pursued this cause. And I think that's kind of curious. So I describe that in the book.
It's not unusual in the sense that anyone who studies Russian history, as I have, knows that anything called the complete collected works of X isn't complete. It just goes without saying. It is not complete.
Absolutely.
There is something not in there that the author didn't like. And I think, this tendency to want to remake our past in service of the present is pervasive in all people, I think. But it is very interesting in the case of someone like Galsworthy. What did people remember his wartime service in this cause, or was it more or less forgotten during his life?
It was more or less forgotten during his life. The thing that he's really most known for, aside the Nobel Prize, is really the Foresight Saga, and understandably so, I guess, if you like the Foresight Saga. The historical record shows that even in his private papers. He didn't talk about this. There was little acknowledgement of it. When he did receive the prize, the Nobel Prize, he was not present because he was too ill to be physically in Sweden for the award ceremony. There was recognition that he was a real humanitarian, but not any specific recognition of his work for disabled soldiers. That might be asking too much. That there might have been, but he was known as a humanitarian. But it's been a footnote, really, in history. And in modern historical scholarship, several historians, most notably Seth Coven, wrote a wonderful piece in, I think it was the 1994 volume of the American Historical Review, a wonderful piece on disabled soldiers and disabled children in World War I. And that was really the first piece that recognized Galsworthy in a way that I try to telescope significantly in my book. And other historians of World War I, sociocultural historians, have recognized Galsworthy vis-a-vis disabled soldiers in a sentence or a paragraph, but not telling the full story that I attempt to tell in my book.
Mm-hmm. Now, he wrote a lot after the war,
yes.
A very productive period for him, even though he did die young, I guess we would say.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the question that I suppose everybody asks you, but it has to be asked. What impact did his wartime experience and advocacy have on his later writings?
That's a difficult question. It didn't have much. I think it from a literary perspective, it was kind of the last flourish of his creativity in many ways. It certainly, the themes of this didn't percolate up in later works. But I think it did have a significant impact in the sense that his war experience had a significant impact in that it really demoralized him for the rest of his life. So although he was productive, his energy was not as it was before the war. His creativity was not as it was before. And literary tastes had changed so that modernism, as it had emerged, became much more defining of the literary landscape and modern taste, so if you will. So
yeah.
Galsworthy was kind of thrown out with the rest of the bunch. I mean, even before the war, Virginia Woolf had it in for Galsworthy, and I talked about this.
I was going to say you have some really what we would call money quotes from Virginia Woolf,
right?
Who really doesn't sound like a very nice person at all.
No.
That's just my impression.
Not at all.
She's not somebody I'd really want to sit down and have coffee with. Talk about an acid pen. Yeah, she has it in for Galsworthy in a big way.
Yes, she does. She did. She wrote a piece called Mr. Bennett and Mr. Brown, in which she just takes Galsworthy apart alongside many of his colleagues who were rooted in that late Victorian Edwardian sentimentalist style. And she says something like, the novels don't really do anything except, provide some, detailed account of people's personal lives, and they're not reflective of the realities that we face, in this age. And so, yes, she had it in for him. And so from a literary perspective, I guess I don't take issue with her. And I'm a historian. I'm not a literary scholar. I wrote this book with Woolf's criticisms, in mind, but really felt that Galsworthy deserved some resurrection, if you will, in light of what he tried to achieve during this very difficult period for Britain and for himself too, as I describe in the book. So I hope that people will, Woolf's criticisms notwithstanding, will at least read Galsworthy's work and appreciate the historical context, the cultural context that I try to bring to it in my piece.
Well, I think you achieve all of that and more, and just bringing to light this very odd fact that Galsworthy had a significant amount of experience, not directly at the front, but at least with the war and that he had written pretty extensively and that he had worked in various semi-official capacities during the war for disabled soldiers, but then it simply disappears from his writings. Is it a significant thing? That is what I think the postmodernists call the present absence. Hemingway went to war and he came back and he wrote about war.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Galsworthy sort of went to war and he came back and he wrote about the Forsythes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very different thing, and
it does
speak to his. I guess it speaks to his mentality, his ability to block these things out. It's just very curious. It's one of these things that one wants to speculate endlessly about. But apparently he didn't write an autobiography, did he?
No. There was a collection in the early 30s, mid-30s rather, a collection of his papers and his correspondence by a longtime colleague, and there were several biographies of him by those who were very close to him, and even those don't reveal, alongside, of course, Galsworthy's original papers, which I've consulted, at least in one archive, there is no reflection upon the war period beyond correspondence. And I end my critique in the book with this, where he says that the war destroyed, he said, I don't know what to call it, a whole lot of faith in me. And that was kind of the poignant moment in this correspondence, the date of which I would need to look up in my own book, where he says, you know, the war ruined me. It ruined my creativity. It destroyed my energy. And I think that's kind of the poignant, the real pivotal point in his life, where he recognizes this, communicates this to a close colleague of his.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So,
where are Galsworthy's papers now? Who has them?
So there are two big collections of Galsworthy's papers. One is at the University of Birmingham in the UK. The other collection is held by Steve Forbes, the businessman, and that was the collection that I relied upon very heavily in my research. And as I state at the outset of my book, I'm very much indebted to Mr. Forbes for providing me the access to that collection, which is again in his private hands.
Why you'll have to, I did note that. Why does Steve Forbes have many of the papers of John Galsworthy?
So the Forbes family, for several generations, has had a tremendous interest in the arts and literature, and so that generally is the reason why they hold that collection. It was purchased from Christie's, and that's generally the reason why.
Good for them. That's what I say.
Well, I agree.
Money well spent.
Yeah, I agree, and the access was much appreciated, and the significant thing is that had that collection not been purchased, I don't know where it would have gone. It could have gone to the University of Birmingham. I don't know the story behind that, and I probably should, but there's something to be said for those who appreciate history and art, who have the means to collect it, and who have the generosity to make it available to scholars like myself. So
yeah,
that's not lost on me in any way.
I couldn't agree more with that, and kudos to Mr. Forbes and his family, because anything that could be done to preserve these things is a most excellent thing. I don't care whether it's in private or public hands.
Yes.
As long
yes.
as they are preserved, that
yes.
is, from the historical point of view, all I really care about.
Yes, yes. And so, in fact, they are preserved very, very well in his home in London, in Battersea, where I went. And they're done so and very much in close cooperation, as I understand, with the Fine Arts Society. So it's done in a really professional way.
That's terrific.
And they're wonderfully cataloged, and they are tremendous. Revealing in the way that I try to reveal myself in this book.
That's terrific. And for those people who are interested in seeing the ones at Birmingham, they're obviously open. But for other people who want to see them in the Forbes collection, do you just simply contact the Forbes Trust or something like that? Or?
So the Forbes Forbes has an office in New York, and if someone wanted to consult the papers for research purposes, that would be the proper avenue to go through. And the University of Birmingham, their collection is accessible through the internet, and you can make an appointment there as well. Now, I should say, I admittedly did not go to Birmingham, and that was largely due to the means that I didn't have to get over there on that occasion to make that research trip. So I am conscious of that, and but that's maybe a related project I can undertake. Yeah. I have been back in touch with Birmingham in recent months for a related project, and perhaps I should do a volume two or something like that.
Yeah, I think you probably should. So on the topic of related projects, we've taken up a lot of your time, Jeff, and we would be interested, though, before we close the interview, to hear what that related or next project is.
So I'm interested in undertaking a cultural study / history of medicine study of the prisoner of war experience in Britain during World War I. One significant individual who was a prisoner of war happened to be Galsworthy's nephew, and his life story is something that's particularly interesting to me, not merely because it intersects with Galsworthy's, but for other reasons related to this gentleman's creativity. He was a poet and an artist, quite a good one, I think, and the record that he left, which is quite fragmented, Birmingham has some of his material, but it's elsewhere that I've tracked down, reveals a story, a part of the story of the prisoner of war experience that I'm interested in examining from a psychological perspective, and that fits. That type of study, as it relates to other figures as well, fits with my interest in cultural history of the Great War and history of medicine.
Mm-hmm. So you will, I happen to know that you will be working your day job, writing that book, and taking care of a new child as well.
Yes. So I became.
So you're not busy at all. We can drop.
No, not at all. Not at all. I became a father for the second time 6 weeks ago, and two beautiful girls at home with my wife. So yes, got my hands full, but pleasantly so.
Well, congratulations on all that.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the book. I really enjoyed reading it. I should tell our listeners that we have been talking to Jeffrey Resnick about his book, John Galsworthy and the Disabled Soldiers of the Great War. Jeffrey, thank you very much for being on the show. We really appreciated it.
Thank you, Marshall, and thanks again for your interest in the book.
Okay, take care.
Thank you. Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Jeff Resnick about his new book, John Galsworthy and the Disabled Soldiers of the Great War. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.